Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World Thursday interview on the 15th of October 2020. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman, and today I'm delighted to be joined again by David Thornton, editor of Growth Company Investor, and now the new owner, having acquired it, the publication from Bonhill. Congratulations, David. Tell us a little bit about what the new ownership means for GCI and its subscribers.
Well, thanks, Tamsin. And yes, it does feel a bit strange to be an entrepreneur at the age of 60. So very much looking forward to getting stuck into it. I've been the editor of GCI for 5 years now. So having the opportunity to take over the ownership of the magazine is something I'm very, very happy and very excited about. It's allowed me to set up a new website with extra features for members, and it'll allow me just to develop the business as we go forward. I mean, and GCI, just a couple of quick words on it. It's basically a digital e-magazine. It's a PDF, 24 pages, 8,500 words, which goes out monthly. I've now got the full backlog since I've been editor of 5 years worth online for historians to download. And I get very, very good access to management. And I love talking to companies, interviewing CEOs and so on. And that very much informs and bases a lot of the content in the magazine. I do an Outlook piece, and I also manage a little paper portfolio, GCI portfolio, which, as you can see from the slide, has done reasonably well over time. It's not really a portfolio management service I'm offering, but the GCI portfolio just helps illustrate the trials and tribulations and the opportunities of running small cap money, and shows you what can be done with a little bit of luck and a fair wind. It's been great fun the last 5 years, and very much looking forward to cracking on with it under new ownership.
Tremendous. And just remind us how you ended up as editor of GCI.
I started life from university as an equity analyst in 82. So I'm an old chap now, sort of 38 years in the game. I've always done equities. So I was very lucky to sort of just land into something which I had a real affinity for and really enjoyed doing. Most of my career was spent at Henderson's. I decided to stop commuting in my early 50s and switch to writing, which I've always enjoyed doing. And since 2015, I became editor of GCI. And as I say, I'm very fortunate in loving doing what I do. So and great to have now got the ownership of GCI as well.
Super. So when we spoke back in July, you picked 6 companies. Do you want to tell us how they've done since?
Well, I'll be delighted to tell you how 5 of them have done since. There's it's not a bad list, but there's one obviously big blot on the landscape. But I'll take them in batting order. The All Share, as we probably know, I mean, I priced this up on Monday night, I think. So the All Share, as we know, has done pretty much nothing over the over summer and early autumn. You can see from the top line there. The middle column shows a return to October. And at the end, we've got, if you had perfect foresight, that's what you could have achieved if you'd have sold out at the top. And I should preface this by reminding everybody that equity investment is not a 3.5-month game. It's long term, and I wouldn't want to judge anybody's return over such a short period of time. However, Venture Life, I think, at the time I did the last presentation with you, Tamsin, back in July, was very much a conviction pick. And I hope that came across when I was presenting it, because it was very clear that we were going to get upgrades, and those have come through now. The stocks responded very nicely, up 25%. Looking at forecasts for next year, they still look too low to me. We've got a bonanza year this year, with revenue going from 20 million to 30 million. Next year, I think brokers are going for like 33, are falling back to 10% growth, which just doesn't look right to me. And even on those figures, it's on 16 times next year. So still a very happy with that one. And I would probably still for choice be a buyer of it. Acrol, shame it didn't hold above 50p. I'm a little bit disappointed to see it just drift back. But again, very comfortable with that one. I think we'll make good money on that on a 2 to 3 year view. The story's still intact. Codemasters have reported, not reported just yet. I think the numbers come out at the end of November, but they updated pre-close, a blowout first half, way ahead of, I think, people's forecasts. I think it's a terrific story. My only disappointment with it is the, slightly grudging performance that we've seen since we talked about it, because the trading has definitely been better than I think even the bulls would have hoped for. And the shares trade on a big discount to the sector. I mean, it's on a P of around 20 compared to what Team 17 in the mid to high 30s. And Frontier Developments ahead of that. So I think there's still a good re-rating story, and I'm very happy with that one going forward. Victoria's been an interesting one. I mean, the stock has put on 30% in the last 6 or 7 trading days, which kind of tells me that the results due towards the end of November might be quite good. It's a nice geared play on recovery. I'm bullish on homewares, household goods spending, durables in general, and I think it's a good way of playing that. And terrific momentum just at the minute. Now the blot, Manolet. Apologies for anybody who listened to me on this one. The sector itself has been pretty lackluster. I mean, litigation capital has had, I think, some very good results and very good developments in how that business is going. Market doesn't care. Rosenblatt or RBG, as it is now, again, it been derated. So I think the main thing people are concerned about here is probably the debtor book. It turns around its cases pretty quickly, but it takes time to collect in the money that it's owed after winning those cases. And the market's just savagely derated it. It's now on 12 times current year, falling to 8.7, and then I think 6 times the following year. So awfully cheap, and scope for it to recover, I think, some credibility once we get more evidence of how the debtor book is evolving and the numbers come through. AFH, like a lot of small companies, they can just go to sleep for long periods of time. And this one is in a dormant period, 10 times current year earnings, 3% yield. I'm still happy to hold it.
From the recent round of results interviews, what are your picks from there? Which companies do you feel have the greatest opportunity for share price growth?
Well, I've picked a fairly eclectic bunch this time. I think we're starting off with Gaming Realms. Actually, it's quite interesting. The share price chart for the first, I think, 4 or so companies, I'm talking about maybe 5, looks fairly similar. So clearly, this has stopped with some momentum. I first spoke to them a few years ago, and the shares had fiddled around, not really doing anything like a lot of these microcaps do. And then clearly something very interesting started to happen in the middle of this year with this big breakout, which encouraged me to sort of get up to speed with the story. The company's main asset is something called Slingo, which is an online real money and social game. So real money, it's a gambling game. It's a cross between bingo and slots, and it's got very good brand recognition, particularly in the States. It's been around actually since the late 90s. So it's not a fad. It's got good durability. When I first spoke to the company, they had a business to consumer strategy. They were looking to sign up players to their own site and effectively own those players and own the 100% of the profits those players would generate. The problem with that for a smaller company is that the costs of, of acquiring players, customer acquisition costs can be very high, and also compliance. There's an awful lot of compliance hoops that gambling companies have to jump through in terms of their marketing, how they're marketing to company to consumers, know your customer rules about money laundering, etc., etc. So what they did in 2018 was to make the decision to stop the B2C approach and effectively become a supplier of the game and the back-end technology behind the game to gaming companies who would own the customer. And as a result of that, Gaming Realms would just take a profit share, effectively a license. They were licensing the game and the software and taking a profit share on the revenue that that was earned by the gambling operators. So this switch appears to be working extremely well at the moment. It means that the company's costs are pretty much fixed. R&D costs are flat. That's enough to generate sufficient new versions of the game each year. And because they're not having to go out and market and win the customers, there's just really very limited variable costs, mainly involved in onboarding new platforms and customers. Now, there are two or three avenues for growth here. The big one is the US gaming market, online gaming market opening up. And I think, as we know, the US has always had a sort of fairly old-fashioned attitude towards gambling. And Gaming Realms are in New Jersey, and Slingo's currently got a 3% share of US of New Jersey online casino games, and that's, I think, an $80 million a month dollar turnover. So they've got quite a meaningful share of the New Jersey market. Pennsylvania, they're signed up to go, and that's expected to open next year. And Michigan soon behind that. There's talk of, I think, Illinois coming on as well, which will be a big population state. And the US states, the law was clarified, I think, a couple of years ago, which allows states to open up to online gaming. They're obviously, like most governments, very keen to get hands on revenue at the moment. So I think there's good momentum behind this market opening up. On top of that, Gaming Realms can expand their exposure on platforms and distributors that they use to access the end customer. For example, one of the larger distribution platforms that they're on, they're only on, I think, 50 out of 200 gaming companies who operate on that distribution platform. So there's plenty of scope to expand that way. And a couple of European markets where they're looking to enter, Italy and Spain, which are potentially very large markets for them as well. So there's plenty of growth opportunities there. And the financial modelling is, with that fixed cost base, the drop through as revenues grow will drop through to the bottom line. So EBITDA margins, I think, are in the teens at the moment. The companies say that they should go to 40% as the business scales up. And looking at forecasts and looking at expectations for next year, I think it's more likely that the 2022 number of 14 million of revenues will see something closer to that in 21. And if we go out a couple of years beyond that, then if the growth comes through as expected, US opens up, then we should be getting revenues up towards 20 million and that higher margin number, which really will drop the PE down to 10 or possibly even sub 10 on that scale. There's clearly plenty of momentum in the stock, as you can see. It's still quite a modest market cap, 60 odd million. So I just think it's at the speculative end. But I think we can see very clearly how we continue to generate some very strong growth from this one.
Sounds very interesting. And the next one?
This is we're going from speculative high growth to more of a value turnaround. And this reminded me when I was preparing the slide of Acrol a bit, which we spoke about last time, in that you've got well-established business, which lost its way quite badly under the old management team. A new experienced team has come in to take over and is really sort of making some excellent progress in executing a turnaround. I mean, DX originally, the name comes from the document exchange, which is still part of the business. That's a business which grew out of the 1970s postal strikes. I mean, people of my vintage will remember days when post boxes were taped up. And of course, this was before email. So solicitors who needed access to documents overnight and so on were joined as members Document Exchange, which was a private postal network between legal officers. And that business is still very much ongoing. A bit related to that is a secure delivery service, which used to have the passport office contract. You know, if you got apply for a new passport, it was delivered to you through a secure courier, and that was DX. They lost that contract on price, and I think that's part of new management's discipline. But they've got capacity there to fill. But the rest of the business is a combination of freight and one man and two man delivery businesses. The new management did a number of things. I think one of the key things they did was to rewrite walk away from bad business, rewrite contracts, get proper commercial terms in place on the business that they had, to give themselves a chance of recovering profitability. They also decentralized management and decision making. I think quite often in businesses like this, the local management in the depot or in the region know what they should be doing, but you know, some guy in a central office tells them to do something else. So there's been a change in corporate culture, much more sort of commercial, customer focused ethos. You know, some restructuring. There's been some. There'll be some expansion of depots as well. And we're seeing a recovery of profitability into the black, margins. This is not a high margin industry, obviously, but margins should be on an improving trend for the next 3 or 4 years. And forecasts, it was a comment from my last conversation before last with management, where they felt that, you know, forecasts they were very comfortable with them, you know, felt they were conservative. And interestingly, and this is a bit of a theme with quite a few companies I've been speaking to recently, the trading is ahead of the pre-COVID budget at the moment. So business has come back very strongly, and they're trading better than they expected to be trading before the pandemic struck. And you know, clearly logistics, moving parcels and packages around is, it's a competitive business, but it's also a growing one. And a lot of their competitors are, capacity constrained. So that augurs well for, I think, for, you know, help on pricing and margin, which is a big part of the story. And, you know, if they make those numbers, the shares ought to double over the next couple of years. And, you know, the suggestion is they could perhaps do a little bit better than that.
What margin are they targeting, do you know, across all areas?
I think if they get to a mid single digit number, that would be that would be a decent result. I mean, it's a mix of double digit margins in some types of business, and then obviously lower ones in other types of logistics. But something in the sort of 5% region would be a good result to aim for on a sort of more, that's more of a sort of medium term view. I mean, we're in this sort of looking to be moving into the sort of 2-3% sort of region at a group operating level.
Great. And moving on to the next one.
The next one is an interesting one. No table here, as you can see. It's a special situation. And when I was going through this ahead of the presentation, I thought, gosh, there's a lot of detail here. And so I did a blog post, which I put up on the website for members to go through in more detail, and that's actually one of the nice things I've been able to do since taking over GCI. Now, Think Smart owns it says a residual 10% stake in Clearpay. It actually owns 6.5% net because the other 3.5% Clearpay's ESOP, employee share ownership plan, has got a rights to that. So it's effectively net a 6.5% stake in Clearpay. Now, ThinkSmart has got an Australian background. It came to the UK in the early part of the century, providing financing products, leasing products for Dixons, who until recently, or actually at the moment, is still a customer. That legacy business is being wound down and they're not writing any more new business. They started Clearpay, a subsidiary, up in beginning of 2018. And Clearpay is a buy now, pay later product. It's a short-term budgeting product for customers. At the point of sale, you're given the opportunity to spread your purchase over three or four payments over 2 or 3 months. So you can just spread a larger purchase over 2 or 3 paychecks. And retailers like it because it encourages bigger basket sizes and customer loyalty and so on. And they were copying a product which had been pioneered by Afterpay, which is a large Australian company. And Afterpay, I think, got pretty much a monopoly of this sort of product in the Australian on the Australian market. So they started this in early 18, and then 6 months later, Afterpay came along and bought them out. Effectively, they sold out to Afterpay, but they retained this 10% stake to give them upside in the growth that Clearpay could generate. Now, Afterpay, the decision to sell to Afterpay, I think, was, you know, why slug it out against a much bigger company who's just going to swamp you? From Afterpay's point of view, it's a case of, well, we've got a ready-made infrastructure in the UK that we can just accelerate our growth in that market. Afterpay are also growing strongly in the US and they're moving into Asia as well. So ThinkSmart sold out, but they've got this 10% stake left. Now, there is a clear exit route. Afterpay have the right to buy that minority out in August 23. And 6 months later, ThinkSmart have the right to sell the minority to Afterpay. There's a valuation formula, which will be linked to how well Clearpay has done and what proportion, effectively, of Afterpay's value can be attributed to Clearpay. Now, that is clearly going to be dependent on Afterpay's valuation and share price. Now, Afterpay, as you can see, is a 25 billion Aussie dollar market cap company. At June, the last year end, the NAV of ThinkSmart was struck at 62.4p, which is a pretty big discount to the current share price, which is around 42, 43. And the value of the Clearpay stake in that was valued at 50 pence. Now, that 50 pence reflects a 20% discount to reflect the fact that it's an illiquid holding. And this is just valuing the financial asset in the account. So it's not its true all-in value. So there's a 20% discount there. And it was also worked out as a point within a range of values that an independent party had provided. But it was carried at 50p, so we're still at a discount. Now, since June, Afterpay shares have gone up 46%. I said 46% in the valuation there, but they're now a little bit more than that. That was at, I think, $90. Last night they closed at $95 compared to $61 in June. So, you know, Afterpay is on an absolute roll. And if you take a crude sum and say 10% of Afterpay's active customers are in the UK. So let's say 10% of Afterpay's market cap is attributable to its UK business. I mean, that's a rule of thumb. It's probably not going to be too far off the mark. And if you work that out, that gives you a valuation of Clearpay of 90p of value for ThinkSmart at current market cap and performance levels. So 90p of value, plus there's another 12p of NAV down to cash and so on. So that's giving you an all-in valuation of ThinkSmart north of a pound. The big risk, of course, is Afterpay, like a lot of fintech growth stocks, is on an enormous market cap for its. It's on, I'm trying to remember what multiple of revenues it's on. It's a pretty hefty valuation. So there's clearly risk to the Afterpay valuation there. And that's something anybody looking at the shares needs to get their head around. But it's just struck me as being a very interesting special situation and opportunity, really.
What's driven the Afterpay price over the last few months? Is that robust, what that's based on?
Well, it's clearly a pretty impressive market cap. So it's not it's we're not looking at a micro cap here. We're looking at a pretty big company. I think you have to look at what's happened to NASDAQ, what's happened to tech stocks in general, fintech companies. Visa and MasterCard are two of the very best performing shares on Wall Street over the last 10 years. I mean, the market really does pay through the nose for payment platforms if you get it right. And, we're in a market which puts very high multiples on growth. I mean, Afterpay's revenues are forecast to quadruple over the next 3 years, hence the very high valuation. I mean, this is a very fast-growing business. The US clearly is a big opportunity for them. But incidentally, the UK, Clearpay, is, in terms of its active customers and their spend and the frequency of their spend, in other words, the value of the customers, in the UK, Clearpay's customers are actually performing better than Afterpay's US customers are, which incidentally would argue for a slightly higher than straight 10% proportional value of the Clearpay stake. But, we're getting into the minutiae there. I think it's just one of those interesting situations that crops up from time to time in the micro cap and small cap world.
Absolutely. And moving on to your next pick, which one is that?
I am bated breath to find out. I am iMobile. I mean, this is a company I've followed for a long time. I first followed them in, spoke to Jay Patel in 2014, and I think I've got 21 pages of notes from subsequent interviews with the company. And as you can see from that share price, it can be a bit frustrating at times. It will go to sleep for periods and then we'll have results and the market wakes up and gets a bit excited and then it might. So just be aware, we could just see a little bit of a drift back. But the business, well, it's one of the nice things when you talk to management and follow a story over a period of time, particularly in the tech area, you see how it evolves and develops with the changes in technology and so on. And iMobile's background, as the name implies, is very much in mobile communications. It used to have most of its business was, a large part of its business was in emerging markets, where it provided value-added services for mobile network operators and so on. In the UK, it had a very good range of blue chip customers where, I mean, an example would be you've booked British Gas to come and service your gas boiler, and you get a text message reminding you of it the night before, and then you get a text message the next morning saying our engineer will be with you between 10 and 11. And that's what IMI Mobile specialised in, providing the software platform to allow the likes of British Gas and so on to send those messages out, which is all about that bottom point there, customer experience. I think this is a sort of concept which has become much more prevalent in recent years, that you compete with your peers through providing your customers with a better experience, a better all-round experience, rather than just basically trying to sell them the product at the lowest possible price. We value the overall experience more. Now, IMI has morphed into one of those wonderful acronyms, CPaaS, as in software as a service. This is communication platform as a service. So this is subscription rental revenue of the software, which is providing the corporate customers with a platform to communicate with the clients, through their customers, through the whole range of channels, omni-channel approach. So it's not just mobile, it could be email, social media, etc. We're also moving into rich messaging services, which I think is going to be increasingly enabled by the likes of 5G and so on, where your message will be much jazzier and more impressive, more informative, have a lot more features to it than just what a few years ago we just get a bald text. And again, that's all part of the customer experience. Now, the whole time I've been speaking to Jay, getting into the US was a big issue. They had a couple of dipped their toe in the water in a tiny way a couple of times, but they've now managed to, and valuation of acquiring US companies was quite daunting, but they've now managed to get their feet under the table there via a couple of acquisitions. I think one's Canadian and the other in the US. And the US now is about, I think it's approaching 25% of revenues, and that's a huge opportunity for them, obviously, that market. Very good growth anticipated going forward. The general market background here is about 15% organic growth in CPaaS. But I'd hope they might, in some periods, be able to do better than that by, gaining market share, really. Valuation-wise, for a SaaS-type software company, those earnings multiples are not uncomfortable. That's slightly backhanded compliment there, not uncomfortable. It's not that cheap. I think there's scope for them maybe to improve on the forecast there. But if you compare it with what peers sell for, and particularly North American peers, this is a very inexpensive valuation. And I'm not suggesting that it's a live takeover candidate, but I think they're building a potentially very valuable property in this space, and particularly they can continue to grow strongly in the US.
Interesting. And let's move swiftly on to the next one, because I'm just aware of time.
I'll try and deal with this fairly quickly then. Motorpoint, they sell cars, car supermarket. Their niche is under 3 years old, and that's I think they claim they're unique in just focusing on 2 and 3 year old, nearly new cars, which you can pick up usually for about half the as new list price. So it's a very simple proposition. It's pilot high, sell it cheap. They turn the stock over 10 times a year. They aim to take, I think it's £600 cash profit per car. They've got 13 sites, soon to be 14. The UK can comfortably take 20, possibly a little bit more. They generate a lot of cash, so they can fund the rollout that themselves. They don't have to go to shareholders for that. They've also, they're omni-channel, to use the phrase. About 30% or so, or more than 30% of sales now come through the website. And they've developed a home delivery. Current trading, we just had a half year update. It's a March year end. So this half year included lockdown months of April and May. And yet they said the first half performance is ahead of 2019's first half. And that's despite having two of the 6 months during lockdown. So they're trading very strongly at the moment. We should get guidance restored in the interim, full interim results in November, I would hope. What I've put there is my kind of an illustration, really, rather than even a guesstimate. 2022 forecast pre-COVID, we're in the 25 to 26 pence of earnings. I've just put 23.6 in there, just it seems like a sensible uplift, and they're only on 12 times that. So I mean, they could be on they could be on a more modest multiple than that. It's just a nice organic growth story, very simple, very high return on capital, very good cash generation, and trading very strongly, and I would expect it to continue to do very well.
And you're not concerned of another lockdown and how that would impact them?
Well, I think local, yeah, I mean, the risk is local lockdowns, if you've, you know, could impact them to a degree. But I think, you know, the market demand for secondhand cars at the moment is very strong. And they've got these other delivery methods. They've got the website, they've got the home delivery. I'm not very worried about that. Let's put it that way. I'm just not very worried about that.
And moving on to your final pick.
Yeah, I mean, this is a different share price chart from the others. It's not as good a chart, so I fully acknowledge, and therefore, you know, we need to be aware that we're fishing amongst the value in the value pool here. Now, Inspired Energy is it's in a tricky sector. You tend to think of things like UtilityWise, which was a disaster. And U Group, which went to the moon and then crashed back to Earth, as corporate energy buyers and advisors to corporate customers in the energy market. Now, Inspired have got a small part of their business; it's less than 10%, which is involved in energy buying, which it takes a fee for related to energy usage, which has been where the problems have been in this sector in the past, but it's de minimis. It's less than 10%. The big part of the business is energy assurance. Now, what energy assurance is advising corporate customers, so you know, larger businesses, about their energy procurement, just making sure that they're buying properly and professionally and well. They don't take a fee from the energy supplier here. That's in the SME side, and so we don't have to worry about that. So making sure that they're buying their energy well, and then processing their bills, verifying their bills. I think they say the average bill has a 6% error rate on it. So it's checking the bills are right, paying them, doing the invoicing. It's like a outsourcing of that part of the business. For example, Boots is a customer. They have, I think, some like 6,000 electricity meters across their estate. So Inspired deals with all the billing and so on, and provides a lot of analysis and so on of energy usage behind that, which leads on to optimization, which is the other part of the business, which they have got into through acquiring a company called Ignite. Now, optimization is more of a project-based business. As I say, in the assurance side, there's recurring revenues. You're doing it's part of business process outsourcing in a way. You've got recurring revenues of processing electricity requirements and bills, energy requirements and bills every month. Optimization is you'll go into a business and you know, effectively advise them on how they can manage their energy consumption, improve it, what they need to do to bring their costs down, evaluate their carbon emissions and so on. So it's very much a sort of project-based based business. There's obviously great scope for cross-selling here between the two sides, and they've part of the initial phase, they've identified a core group of, I think it's sort of 50 or 60 customers who they think they can cross-sell between, that should help really drive some good growth. On top of that is an ESG opportunity. This is obviously a hot topic for most companies, and there's scope to use the expertise the company has in energy, which is the biggest part of the sort of sustainability pie, as it were, to develop a business which will consult and provide advice and analysis of a company's energy footprint and for ESG purposes. I think increasingly companies are being pushed to provide good quality audits of their ESG issues, and so that could develop into a decent business for Inspired. The stock, as you can see, is on a low rating, modest rating. There is a slight wrinkle here, in that, as I mentioned earlier, that UtilityWise and U Group got into problems because their revenues were based on forecast consumption of customers, Now, Inspired don't do that. They assure me that they that is not part of the model in the main corporate business. However, traditionally, the industry has billed customers in insurance by reference to the bills. And of course, we had during lockdown and so on, energy consumption plummeted. You know, if your shops were closed, they weren't consuming much energy, and your energy bills went through the floor. And Inspired had worked out what they were charging you on the basis of taking a slice out of those invoices. So that has hit this year's revenues to an extent. And talking to management, they say that going forward, once contracts are renewed and so on, they're going to look to change. The industry is going to look to change to a more sort of transparent and clear-cut way of charging. So that's been a slight wrinkle, and I think that's what's probably damaged the valuation this year. But if they deliver the growth, they had a fundraise which as will help them continue to consolidate the assurance side. I think it's maybe got towards a 20% market share. And as I say, it's a 10 multiple. So, you know, if they do get it right, there's the scope for this one to to at least get back to the old highs that we saw at the beginning of this year.
Tremendous. Well, that's been a great run through, some great picks. We do have some questions. Miles Ruffle asks, at DX, what does balance sheet and returns on capital look like?
Oh, thank you for that, Miles. I honestly don't have the numbers off the top of my head on the return on capital and so on. It is, and obviously that's me. If most of the assets will be leased, it's an old way of running a logistics truck company. But in terms of, I'm just looking through my notes here to try and get to the. I think from memory, I think we are, we've moved into cash positive territory. We're generating cash, and I think I'm right in saying that the business is net cash. And I can find it here. DX. Here we go. Right. Yeah, net, we've got positive net cash for the current year is forecast to be around about break even, modest positive number, and then 8 million June 22 and 17 million June 23. So growing quite nicely, particularly obviously as profitability is restored. And the company doesn't pay a dividend at the moment, but I think will, and they're keen to come back onto the dividend list. So I think the June 22 year, we'll probably see a restoration of dividends. And I mean, in terms of, well, for what it's worth, this is FinCap, return on capital employed, 33%. But, you know, I can't vouch for how they've done the sums on that.
Great. And we've got a couple of questions on IMI. Miles Ruffle asks, who are the big competitors in the US for IMI?
There are a couple of names, which I might be able to come up here. One point, and this is, I say, I can't claim to have gone in and done the competitor analysis here, but talking to the company over a number of years and their desire to get into the US is that they felt the UK. Market and their product was actually, we were a little bit ahead of the Americans in our use of these sort of customer messaging, appointment clarification and so on approaches. Just bear with me a second, let me see if I can come up with this.
Don't worry too much, we've got quite a lot of questions. So
Twilio and Cinch are a couple of companies to look into.
Great,
Twilio,
thank you.
And Cinch.
Thank you.
Cinch with an S.
And Mark McDonald asks, would IMI potentially list in the US? If it does, will it leave AIM?
I wouldn't imagine so. I don't think that seems to be on the agenda at all. It's still relatively early days in the US as well. You know, it's still a minority of sales. I mean, if it was a majority of sales and management were moving over there, then I think that would probably be more likely. But I just don't see that at all at the moment.
And Vivek Sharma asks, regarding Venture Life, are you concerned about the cash conversion? In the half year, there was a large increase in receivables and capitalized development costs, almost doubled on the previous half year, even though management reported 368% growth in an adjusted EBITDA. Operating cash flow was down 30% on the previous 6 months, and free cash flow was negative.
Well, when a company is growing very, very quickly, you're going to get it requires working capital, and it takes time to get paid. And given the rate of growth in Venture Life in the current year, revenue's up a good 50% or so. That's not something that troubles me. Looking at a half year statement during this period of really rapid development in the company, I do take the point though, and it's something that needs to be looked at. It's not selling direct to customers. It's selling to wholesalers or retailers, so they will have to wait to get the normal time to get paid. So it's definitely something to keep a close eye on. But as I say, given the rapid rate of growth and where we are in the stage of the company's development, it's not something I'd be concerned about just at the moment.
Tremendous. And John Sladden says, thank you, David, for a really interesting presentation. Do you think Realms will need to raise cash to support its working capital as it grows?
No, I mean, that's one of the nice parts of the story. The cost base is pretty much fixed. The R&D isn't going to increase. And in terms of increasing headcount, I think they say it costs them. It can cost £30,000-£50,000 to execute sort of major integration into a platform. So there is some degree of variable costs possibly involved, but they're selling to a limited number of platform businesses and gaming businesses, and they're just selling software and systems effectively. So as I say, I think the growth we get in revenue, there should be a very, very good drop through to the bottom line as cash. So I wouldn't expect that at all.
Thank you. And Bruce Packard asks, or he says, thank you for the presentation. Just wondering how you felt about Manolete now. Would you cut your losses or would you average down?
Well, I'll hold my hand up. I mean, I feel anybody's pain because it's a share I own. And I've got it, obviously got it badly wrong. As I said, in the slide, the two points. One is, the valuation is extremely low. Now the market does not want to put anything like a decent multiple on those earnings at the moment because it's skeptical about, bringing it through into those profits through into cash. And I think, if you look at litigation capital management, okay, it's not had the D rating Manolete's had, but I mean, that's achieved a heck of a lot over last year and has got no recognition for it. So I think the market just does not like these companies. But if Steve Cooklin is writing what he says, then we should see that cash come through over the coming periods. And that should get a better rating than, six times prospective 2 years out. So my feeling is, I got it wrong at these levels. I'm very, very loath to cut it. I really am. So I'm just sitting with it. But then, one of my abiding faults is that I'm not as ruthless as I should be. And every year that passes, I tell myself to be a more ruthless cutter. And maybe I'll eventually learn a lesson. But I'm hanging on for what it's worth.
And we've got a question from James Collier, who asks, what's your take on the recent Argentex half one trading update?
I wrote this company up having spoken to them. And in a way, I should have listened a little bit closer to what they were saying and what the risks were, because it was quite clear that the disruptions of not being able to sort of get into the office, and I think they were in the middle of an office move anyway to larger premises, and that had slowed down the recruitment of new salesmen, which is what drives the business, what drives the growth in the business and the acquisition of customers. So I should have listened a little bit closer to that. Now, having said that, down here, assuming they can get back on the front foot, and I haven't spoken to them since the announcement, it looks like an awfully cheap share. Alpha FX, which is the obvious peer, and that's moving forward on two or three other fronts as well. It's a more sort of slightly more mature story than Argentex in the way the business has been rounded out. They're trading on about a 30 multiple. Admittedly, they always lowball the forecast, but I mean that's radically different to the multiple that Argentex is on, and they're basically doing the same thing, which is hedging for SMEs, and it's a market share story. So, assuming that Argentex can get back on the front foot, start growing again, maybe manage expectations a bit better, just keep the heads down and deliver some numbers, then from these levels, I would expect the shares to do very well. I do need to talk to them. I do need to do a bit more work on the story, but I think what's happened is understandable, and it could be an opportunity. One final point. Companies that are relatively recent IPOs that disappoint always get badly treated by the market, and rightly so. I'm not trying to make any excuses there, and that's something to bear in mind. Whereas Alpha FX had a big slip up with a large bad debt about a year ago, but they've kind of got away with that because I think they generated enough credibility over the 3 or 4 years prior to that happening.
Great. And Martin McLeod asks, Codemasters and Gaming Realms seem to be positioned perfectly for a long, dark COVID winter and should be large beneficiaries of more time spent at home. Will you be adding to your positions as the earnings increase and the growth stories gain momentum?
I'd be very happy buyer of both stocks, I think, at the moment. My personal portfolio, I think Codemasters has just recently become my largest holding outside the investment trust, a sort of single stock holding. So it's a stock I very much believe in. Because of its size, I'm not going to be adding to it. But if I'd only dipped a toe in the water or whatever, I mean, I certainly would. I mean, it's always slightly worrying when you feel out of step with the market. But I look at it on 20 times with some great game franchises and having just blown away the first half, and I don't really understand why it's not trading on a higher rating. But stock's acting well, don't get me wrong, I'm very comfortable with it, so very much like that. And Gaming Realms again, I think at some point, that can get up to, and the chart looks like it wants to. So it's just sort of girding its loins for a run up into the mid to high 20s. But it's speculative. I certainly wouldn't want to have that as my biggest holding. But certainly in terms of the scope, I think it's certainly very much an active buy.
I'm not sure whether you have an answer for this, but Jay Shah asks, with Gaming Realms, what's the next chance of US news, re-gaming in lockdown or Slingo?
Well, I mean, the big thing in the States, let's say, is opening up new states, and it's done on a state by state basis. You have to get you have to get a state license. You have to actually site infrastructure in the state. It is very much sort of state controlled, and let's say Pennsylvania is expected to go live next year. Michigan beyond that. I mean, that's news to look out for. Is just how quickly those new territories come on. I mean, in terms of lockdowns, whatever. I mean, we're doing more and more online, whether we're locked down or not. If we are locked down, then we'd like to be doing a little bit more, I guess. Games you can play on your mobile or handheld device. I mean, it's just a growth market. So I'm again very happy with those stocks.
And one broader question from Matthew Appleyard. He says a lot of your picks are recovery plays and small caps. Are there any quality mid to larger caps that you're looking at? I.e., most of these stock picks have quite a high risk tag that comes with them.
Growth company investor is focused on small caps. That's what we do. So I mean, for example, Future was a stock which I picked up on, I think, about £1.50. And that's been a phenomenal winner. But once that had moved into the FTSE 250 and so on, I kind of let the coverage fall away because, I very much want to stay focused and GCI on small caps. There are some good quality names in small caps and good quality companies. And I think that's one of the things I really would want to emphasize. Where's the financial distress been in the current environment? Well, it's Rolls-Royce. It's not a lot of the small companies that I look at or I've spoken to today where actually balance sheets have been fine. So I would defend not all small caps generically, but I would defend good quality smaller companies as being well worthy of focus within a portfolio, and size is not everything when it comes to quality.
Thank you, David. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. Can you tell us where people can find you?
Well, they can find me at our brand new website, growthcompany.co.uk. There's a lot of information on the homepage where you can also download a free sample copy of GCI. And if you like it and it strikes a chord with you, then please think about subscribing, which you can do via the website as well. There's also a page on the website called Members Manual, which gives more information about how we think about shares and GCI's role in helping you as an investor. And we're also on Twitter at Growth Company, and I promise to start tweeting. I don't have anything about 3 or 4 so far, but that's where we are.
Great. Many thanks, David, and some superb company ideas. If you want an email notification of webinars or events PI World are organising, go to the right-hand side of the homepage at piworld.co.uk. There are two boxes. The one at the top, sign up for a notification of a new video as it's published, and then underneath, sign up for events. They're different lists and there's no spam. And please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards and YouTube. We also produce all the videos as a podcast, so do write reviews for any of the podcasts on iTunes. We'd like to go on providing these free webinars, and getting really good speakers relies on you and the audience numbers we attract. If you have ideas of speakers, do email or message me. You can find me through piworld.co.uk or follow me on Twitter at @TamsinPIWorld. Many thanks to you all for joining, and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.